Hello kids, welcome to episode 10 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written words and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region and their leaders past, present and emerging. The fuck are you, Nick?
Swell. A little too sober, but, you know, that'll happen.
Yeah, we were going to cheers, but you're on a sobriety train.
Yes, just for 1 month.
Nice. Well, let's hope it's horribly unsuccessful.
You're always so supportive.
Thanks, man. Cheers, bro. Ooh. Cheers to our chaste teas. Our virginal teas.
Before we get started, we just want to say that this show is not for kids. And Also, we're going to be spoiling Sopranos a little bit.
Mm-hmm. An episode, a very, very specific episode of The Sopranos. And also reading out a short story that we want to warn everyone is a little bit intense. So just in case. So here we go. For the Bunyip's Pleasure by Nick Petru. When the Bunyip first entered me, leaving me bloody and broken on the riverbed, I wished he had pushed his beak through my skull and finished me off. Time passed, though, and I dreamed of that moonlit scene, my knees and face in the coarse brown sand, now offering myself willingly. Can you imagine it? Being perhaps the last of your Pleistocene kind, with no mate to satisfy one of the most basic urges of life. We all know this urge. But would it not be a thousandfold for this elusive creature, enduring a loneliness we could never understand? With this in mind, it should come as no shock to you that I have since gone back to that riverbed, nor that I have brought you along for the Bunyip's pleasure. But you don't know this yet, do you? No. As far as I can tell, you have enjoyed every minute of this 4-hour drive. A public campsite within Coal Seam Conservation Park. This is where you think we're heading. But wait until I show you my secret spot. You wind down your window and let the hot air blast the natural kinks back into your hair. This is good. The Bunyip will take to you better if you are unkempt. And your first experience among the many I hope we will share will hurt far less. This is why I tossed your deodorant and toiletries bag in the skip bin while you paid for petrol at that last roadhouse. If you hadn't taken your tobacco in with you, I would have thrown that out too. You sing along to Cat Stevens, a CD you bought especially for this trip. You say I look like this cat fellow and that my scruffiness turns you on. You don't know how happy that makes me. Though I can't pretend the idea of intimacy with you excites me anymore. With the others, I would have long since given up. But not you. With you, I am willing to expose the most vulnerable part of myself. It will make us stronger. You lean across the center console of my Land Cruiser and kiss my beard as if somehow privy to my thoughts. And then you're into the bag of mixed nuts, feeding the walnuts to the dirt road, which we follow through seas of wildflowers backdropped by red mesas and gorges and stout green wheat fields. It is a vast landscape, taxing on the mind and its ability to render what the eye detects, and you can hardly believe such a place exists in barren Australia. All of it, my love, is his hiding place. Searching for him, one would never find him. He has to come to you. He has to want you. Oh, I can smell the gamey reek of his fur this very minute, as if I were nuzzled against his chest, deafened by the thud of his heart. Sometimes he stays afterwards, sometimes not. Sometimes he holds me and watches the stars as though dreaming of what might be out there, of possibility. And then his melancholy takes him, and he leaves. When we pass the road leading to the public campsites, the ones bustling with the grey nomads and their terrible caravans, you jab at the map and say three times in quick succession that I missed the turn. This irks me a little, my love. In fact, I don't hate walnuts quite as much as you think. But yes, the jig is up. I inform you of my secret spot, beyond the reach of all but the most vigorous off-road vehicles, a place where you could shout your lungs to deflation, and no one would hear you, except him. Now, don't think I haven't noticed the wariness in the contours of your grinning face. It is not on my account. You trust me fully. It is something else. An instinct as old as prey. I cannot blame your bones for fearing him, but understand that he endures on a spectrum of emotion far broader than our own and would only harm you if he perceives you a threat. His kind were sagely among the great beasts of their day, attuned to layers of mind and reality we could never know. You will find him quite sensitive. We pitch our little green tent among the wildflowers upon a plateau overlooking the riverbed. A pair of kangaroos bound across the sandy floodplains and melt into the shadows of the riparian trees. What's that? I'm gathering rocks and didn't hear you over the wind. Yes. We should use the sun while it's out. There's a game trail through the wildflowers. You lead, squatting in your khaki shorts to interrupt a train of ants with a sultana, or to stroke the lip of an orchid. Yes, Diurus tinkeri, the donkey orchid, I'm well aware. I won't put a halt to your enthusiasm, though. With every grain of pollen that stains your skin, and every seed that catches in your hair and clothes, you reek more and more of the bush. If I could, I would rub every crevice of you with the oils of his domain. Seated upon a lichen-spotted boulder, the wind tugs your hair from your throat, and you behold the valley through which the river, now but a chain of puddles, surges in winter. The valley's naked walls are wonders of colour in and of themselves, rivaling the wildflowers. Yes, yes, it is very much like a cake, layers upon layers of silts and sands and clays, a formation more than 250 million years old. How much, I wonder, would it have changed in the golden years of Bunyip society? Oh, how I love to let my mind run free with such thoughts. They must have lived in caves, of course, or in the hollows of giant trees. They sang in cross-legged circles, weaving tales of the bush and their magic and their gods. Little bunyips darted between the legs of their elders and chased lizards up trees. Their mothers raised them in pouches, and their fathers hunted and butchered the other great beasts so their young would grow strong, and they knew love. Yes. Yes, they knew love. Your lighter sparks, and I am upon you in an instant. Not here. How could you do that here? I grind your cigarette to dust and pocket what remains. Your pupils dilate and your instincts are tugging at you again, imploring you to jam a finger into my eye or bite a piece from my cheek. But you won't. I struck a fine balance in you. You aren't inanimate. That would bore him. But you haven't the fight to hurt him either. You struck back to camp, leaving me alone with the butterflies and the setting sun and the wild oats. I wait until the valley falls to shadow, then return and build our fire. The fire burns low and the moon ascends, a blinding sickle spotlighting this windless night. Your Shiraz dulls your anger, glazes your eyes. Our argument might never have happened. You say we should move in together. Oh, what a fantastic idea. You kiss my ear and shuffle your camping chair closer to mine. You hint at what we might do on our air mattress with the outer layer of the tent peeled back so the stars could watch. In good time. In good time. Save yourself. Let it build. The crescendo will come. And you must eat too. You will need your strength. Now it is silent, except for the crackling jarrah. It is getting to that wild hour in which the bunyip's eyes, white as polished quartz, are widest. He will call any minute now. My bowels soften in anticipation. I can hardly contain myself and hope wholeheartedly that you won't quite sate him, that he will come to me, Old Faithful, for dessert. And there it is. His mating call. A sonorous chortle that rumples my skin. You wince and squeeze my arm. But fear not, my love. That was only a bird. Now if we are going to live together to commit ourselves to each other, that means we cannot keep secrets. I have a secret. Something ancient and magical and glorious beyond compare. Switch your headlamp to red and come with me. We take a trail along the rim of the plateau to where it melds with the gentler slopes of the valley. There are plenty of trees and outcrops to brace ourselves on during our descent, which is not as high as it looks. Your knees tremble, but you have to trust me. This is all about trust. I have taken this path many times. If it were dangerous, we wouldn't be here. A kiss tips your scales away from instinct and back into my favor. The bunyip makes a second call, inflecting his final note, and my excitement grows. He hungers tonight. His loneliness is almost unbearable. Once you slip, but I am there to catch you. You feel my tumescence against you and wonder if this is what I wanted to show you. You are lust drunk with the promise of it, and believe me, you won't be disappointed. We reach the base with a few minor cuts and bruises and follow the footprints of the kangaroos out onto the sand. We kill our headlamps. I couldn't ask for a more perfect night. There is no wind, so I know that the rustling of the trees on the far side of the riverbed is him. The stars? Are they what I wanted to show you? No. Then what? You will see. You will see. Close your eyes, my love. And no matter what you hear, trust me that all is well. The Bunyip whimpers, more afraid of you than you are of him. I ease his mind with a long, soft whistle, a signal he has come to associate with safety and love. In response, another of his calls, far louder now. You cling to me as if a wall of floodwater were about to rush around the bend and wash us dead. It's okay. It's okay. I tuck your face into my chest. His reek oozes through the air, hot and heavy. You wriggle, playfully at first, and then like I've buried you alive. Your strength surprises me, but it's not enough, and I know you will soon acquiesce. You always do. Oh, how can I describe the beautiful, wretched creature walking out of the trees towards us? Mammalian would do him no justice, nor would avian encompass him. Something in between, a wingless bird with naked white ears as proportionally long as a fox's. A fool might mistake him for a standing bear, albeit a starving one with a pelt more like human hair than fur. You almost break free of me. But do you really want me to let you go? Really? Here then, I thrust you to the sand, and when you scrabble to your knees, you are right beneath him. You go to shriek, but his steam rushes into your lungs, and you choke instead. He descends. I remember when I was where you are now, fright devolving to shock, shock to despair. There won't be pleasure this first time, not for you, but I promise you'll grow to want him. And as three, our love shall bloom. Try to understand his loneliness, his need. How could we deny him that? I can hardly deny my own. Imagine his glory 100,000 years ago, long before man trickled into this land and hunted its megafauna to extinction. Imagine him mounting another of his kind, the gamey redolence of their copulation, the craters made in the sand by their knees. We can never give him that, never. And soon you will know the pain of that truth. But this, what we do for him, here, here, this is noble, noble work. I wonder, though, does he quiver like that when he is with me? Does he aim his beak at the stars, rendered half blind in his pleasure? Surely I would remember that. I don't understand. What are you giving him that I cannot? Why does he wheeze now as if the rising pressure might kill him, as if he can't believe it could ever be this good? I release my tumescence and bend the way he likes me to bend. I open myself and mimic his cry as well as my human lungs and throat will allow me. And still, he acts as though I am not here, too caught up in his passion, too caught up in you. You. I get to my feet and take one step towards you and his eyes meet mine. There's threat within those rolling pearls. Take another step, they say, and you will lose me forever unless I kill and feast upon you right here. And as if to mock me, your mouth makes an O. No. No, 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 that is no false sign of pleasure. You greet his thrusts with thrusts of your own, a rhythm I've never achieved. You clench his hair in your fist and tug it, as if you, like him, can scarcely bear the throes of your own pleasure. This is treachery. I should never have brought you here. You with your Cat Stevens and your cigarettes and your wine. You with your direst tinkery and your walnuts and lies, your lies. Move in together. I would rather the bunyip pinch out my throat right now. I would rather him rake my guts into the sand. How could I have trusted you? You. He loves you. And that means that he never loved me. The end.
Jesus fucking Christ. Jesus fucking Christ, man. That was an excellent reading. Well done. Oh, you haven't done that before. Like, yeah, that was voice acting. That was excellent, mate.
As I said, I've been playing heaps of Elden Ring. We love those From Software games, Demon's Souls, Dark Souls, Bloodborne, all that. And the voice actors are always stupendous, even if they're saying the most like ridiculous things, yeah, to sell it. And I'm thinking, you know what? Voice acting's really fun. Let's just do it.
Fuck, that was awesome. Hey, I was just like holding myself back, like trying not to just be like, fuck, this is great. You know, like when you're watching a really good movie in the cinema and you want to tell someone, it was like that.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. That man, you, okay, so just a bit of context, right? You wrote that story 6 months ago?
Yeah, probably about that.
About 6 months ago. And I remember you sent me that story and I read it and I had one question for you. And that question was, why? why does this exist? And it still stands. I want to know, but like that was a lot better than I remember reading. Like, for some reason, I was like, "Is he just like, is he just into this? Is this who he wants Sarah to be?" I don't know.
Well, I guess before I answer the why or try to, one of the first things that you actually said, I saved the message. You said, "Goodness me, that story was the weirdest, grossest, rapiest, most purple, most." Purple piece of prose I wager you will ever write in your silly little life. I feel cursed.
I mean, I do still feel cursed. I feel like I've been cursed since then. But man, I don't know, like that was, man, it was really, especially with the voice acting behind it, like it really came to life, I think. Like it was really, it's really a twisted little horror story. Like it's really gothic and gruesome. In a way that's, it is really spine tingling. Like, that's a scary story, dude.
Yeah, you can feel the dread building. You know what's happening pretty much from the get-go, and you can feel it building throughout.
Yeah, he's like, he's giving his girlfriend over to a swamp monster.
Oh, well, yeah.
He is also beholden to.
Yeah. I didn't give his partner a gender. So that's left open, and that's because, like, he's talking about you. So it might help the audience kind of put themselves in their shoes where,
yeah, true.
You know, if you want to be in those shoes.
I guess I just like heteronormalized it just then. I'm probably, yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah, you've definitely, yeah, actually, yeah, you made it very strategically vague. Damn, it's just, that's a really interesting perspective to tell a story from.
Yeah.
Like essentially you're telling a story from the perspective of a very active villain. Yeah. Like someone who is actively like in the process of the story doing something twisted and terrible, you know, and he's plotting it out and you're with him for every one of his machinations. Kind of reminded me of like Lolita, but in the Australian outback.
We talked about this in one of the earlier episodes, the one on perspectives. I can't remember which episode that one was.
Four.
Okay. And we spoke about the first person referral POV. Yeah. That's what that was.
Is that right?
So it's like, you know, the POV character is speaking in first person, but then they're addressing a you.
Yes.
So it's different from second person where there's no first person POV.
Is that the same perspective you used for that one? I really like you showed me ages ago, Made of You?
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't read it on the podcast yet. We want to, We have to wait for the rights to get
So they've still got to publish it, and then there's like a cooling down period that we'll have to wait for before we can put it on the podcast. But, you know, we're getting away from ourselves. The why. I don't know why. I actually don't know why. I went traveling.
I forgot I asked that because I was like, that's not relevant. Nick's imagination is imagination. My auntie messaged me the other day and she was like, your friend Nicholas, wow, his stories. What's with them? And I'm like, he's fucked up.
Tell her I said thanks.
I did, yeah.
But yeah, I went to Coliseum National Park with my mate Mike, and we were like just like tumbling through the wildflowers and mushrooms, and it was a great old time. And then I was
thought
like,
of the bunny.
No, not while I was there. Yeah, it's just me and him camping together, and I was thinking about that.
This would make a great story.
Now, I came home and I was like, I want to write a monster story, and I want to write something set in Australia because I've just been to Coliseum and the visuals are super fresh in my mind.
It was very vividly captured, I think, in the story.
Yeah, I felt that way too. And then I was like, okay, yeah, they go there and then get killed by the monster. Like, that's a pretty typical sort of plot. And I was like, I want to do something a little different, and I want to experiment with POV. So then that's what came out of it. And instead of being killed by the creature, something else happens. And I thought that was kind of something fun to play with. And the whole thing, the whole story for me was just me, like, testing things out.
I know I sent you that message that you read out, and you know, and it was quite harsh. I was at the time appalled, but like to be fair, man, you're right though. Like in terms of like a horror story, it's really like more about, you know, like that old adage, like, you know, it's what lurks in the shadows is a lot scarier than, you know, actually seeing maybe someone being killed or torn apart by somebody, some monster. They get dragged off into the shadow. That's so much more terrifying, and I think that's attached to maybe things we're terrified of more than death, which is like maybe like defilement, you know, and something horrendous happening to us while we're conscious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, man, yeah, you really fucking tapped into that. And I hope I creeped out some listeners at home.
Yeah, fucking hell. And once again, mate, that reading was excellent. Thanks, like, you've kind of set the bar pretty high now, so I'm expecting a lot.
Well, but what was the alien story last with the brain slug with like, no.
That was great.
Yeah, I love that insectoid woman. She's lovely, eh?
But what I was going to say as well is that type of POV, I think, really works well with some voice acting.
Yeah.
Because you're not having to do multiple characters or voices. There's no dialogue in that. It's all just in stream of consciousness.
And you are acting that guy's perspective out, you know, which is like a lot. It's very, I felt like it was much easier to do that, to really like twig into it than, I guess maybe a third person story.
Creep, you found voice acting in that character quite easy. Yeah, that makes sense.
I did say that wrong, didn't I? Sorry, Mom. And everyone I've ever known. Why am I just singing out my mum? All right. So thanks for listening, guys. Poetry time?
Yeah, let's do it.
Nectarine by Patrick McCarthy. I once was on mushrooms with my best friend. Sat on the bank of a river down south. We'd smoked a trombone of buds to the end when the urge came over to fill my mouth. With something delectably sharp and sweet, I plunged in the esky and had a glean to be rewarded with a scrumptious treat, a glorious red and gold nectarine. We had many treats with us to enjoy, but stood in their way was this wondrous sphere. Could sense the other food, feeling annoyed, but unfortunately only one choice was clear. Fuzzless skin so refreshingly cold, having been ensconced with ice for the trip. Flawless, with no sign of blemish nor mould. Perfection in my orangutan grip. There I perched amidst the dwelling up trees, slick from the river and lashed with its mud, living the way of the forest with ease, my monkey forebears alive in my blood. Soothed by the rays of a transcendent sun, comfy atop some green lichen-bound rocks, beneath a blue sky whose compare was none, and tripping absolute balls in my jocks. I held it aloft, this marvellous fruit, regarding it as one would a treasure, a garnet plundered from some pirate's loot, contained inside it all worldly pleasure. I brought it close, felt its chill on my face, opened my jaw, my eyes rolled over white, and in the tranquil of that holy place, took a soppingly gargantuan bite. My fangs embedded in that sacred flesh, my red tongue lapped at the nectar forthwith, as it burst apart so lively and fresh, like some goddess's fruit from ancient myth. Freezing cold ichor cascades down my chin, swallowing its new honey-sweet blood until a sonorous voice chides me from within, and I sense all at once the forest goes still. The gentle southern breeze had stopped blowing. The kookaburras quit their scathing japes. The placid river halted all flowing. In all the hush, not a murmur escaped. It was as if time's true arrow had fell, and the slow march of life had ceased to be. All the world slept beneath a magic spell, leaving just us, the nectarine and me. Its glistening innards shone in the light. My fingers caressed it, covered in sap. Its sweet golden juice, an erotic sight. A gift from the gods, at rest in my lap. And all to myself, I relished this piece of nature's splendor bestowed unto me. I began to ache for mystic release, a forbidden love, just yearning to be. Its wetness had soaked all over my chest. Sticky I was as the day I was born, bound to the slick and smooth curve of its breast, I felt a sublime arousal take form. I commenced to effervesce down below. The beast inside me writhed on all fours, and just as our dance had found all its flow, I heard the nectarine whisper, "I'm yours." I couldn't believe this stroke to my ears, this sure removal of struggle and plight. That little voice had assuaged all my fears, and what was once wrong now just seemed so right. I stared at the fruit splayed out in my hands, lying there ready and willing to go. I took a deep breath, cowed to her demands, and inched her toward me, achingly slow. "What are you doing?" said someone close by. I jumped with a start and followed the sound, and spotted my best friend pondering why I was covered in juice and so tightly wound. Reality hits me, I'm left standing numb, and I was still tripping from head to toe. Yet I held out my hand to offer her some, to which she replied, "Yeah, nah, I'm good, bro. Thanks."
What is happening in this episode?
Yeah, no, it's there's
we're off the rails, baby.
We are a little bit off the rails. Yeah, it's like Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty, sponsored by Pornhub.
That was fucking weird, man.
Yeah, man. Very weird.
You really liked that nectarine.
Yeah, I did, yeah. And again, like akin to the last time I took mushrooms and thought it'd be great to write a poem, I think all that took place in the space of like 15, 20 seconds. Like I was just tearing apart this nectarine like a fucking chimp. Like I was clutching it. I was covered in it. And I feel like I just had a fleeting thought that, you know, maybe I'd be like Elio from Call Me By Your Name and think it would be a nice place to put your penis in. And then I just ran away with it. I told my sister about it, that I had this little nugget of an idea, and she was laughing and she was like, "Dude, just, you know, don't be cowardly about it. Like if you're going to write about that, just go balls to the wall."
Well, maybe that's the theme of the episode.
Yeah, just a mess.
Yeah.
Let's make episode 10 a fucking mess.
I think No, I think we discussed this briefly in that other episode where you talked about being on shrooms at a festival. You know, you're so conscious at that time and you can obsess over things to that degree. And I think it captures it like really well. Instead of just being like, oh, you know, I was like tripping balls. It was crazy, yo. It's like, this is the actualities of it. This is what's going through your head at the time. Yeah. Like all the little specific sensations. Mm. It's, you know, I think you're showing in this instant instead of telling.
Yeah,
you know?
That's... Alexandra said that to me. Yeah. She said, I think I wrote three stanzas of a previous version of it. And it was like talking about hallucinogenics, shrooms specifically, what, you know, things they make conjure in you. And it was just really on the nose. You know, it was like, how about you just describe like the way the forest is and the way you're sitting and the way you're dreaming about this nectarine and its taste and everything and getting carried away with it in the way that you do blissfully do on mushrooms. It, you know, she's right. It was a better evocation of that feeling, you know.
Nice word.
Just love drugs, eh? All right. So thanks for your feedback, sir.
No worries.
So as Nick said at the outset, there will be spoilers for an episode of The Sopranos. We're really keeping a theme in this episode, you know, rapey swamp monster, Patrick wants to fuck a nectarine, and Tony Soprano's sad, sad face. And I think, you know, we'll leave the theme up to you guys. Stories we love. One of cinema's chiefest pleasures is its divine union of sight and sound to create something sublime. A magic trick unique to the medium that binds music and image together with such graceful alchemy as to become transcendent in ways unforeseen, to which no other artistic medium can truly compare. Since film's inception, musicians have been composing pieces specifically for showcase on screen, operatic orchestral arrangements that wield theme and leitmotif to convey character and emotion. But some of the most iconic, deliriously affecting musical moments in cinema history have been its pop needle drops. The use of pop music in film seems to have originated with Mike Nichols and his inspired weaving of Simon and Garfunkel into his 1967 comedy classic, The Graduate. And for nearly 60 years, filmmakers have been finding enthralling ways to fuse the joys of sight and sound to an extent I doubt Nichols could have ever possibly predicted. Directors like Richard Linklater, Danny Boyle, James Gunn, and Quentin Tarantino are so closely tied to the musical choices of their respective movies that one could easily suspect them to be musicians themselves, such as the refinement with which they score a scene. Each of them would likely herald the maestro of this art to be Martin Scorsese, a man who saw what Nichols did with Mrs. Robinson and simply ran away with it, weaponizing pop songs like a scalpel throughout five decades and many classic films such as Mean Streets, Goodfellas, The Departed, and The Wolf of Wall Street. But even an icon such as he pales in comparison to one David Chase, the genius creator behind the greatest compendium of pop music ever assembled in all of cinema, HBO's acclaimed, hugely influential drama series, The Sopranos. The merits of this hallowed work of television have been expounded to death, and goodness knows that, as great fans of the show, Nick and I will surely find any slim reason to revisit it on the podcast. For now, we will choose to avoid making grand statements about what it does immeasurably well, and instead focus with laser precision upon a single scene of the show, a single moment, that best encapsulates the sorcery betwixt sight and sound that marks cinema out as the last century's defining art form. In episode 7 of the 4th season, an episode entitled Watching Too Much Television, lead protagonist Tony Soprano is depressed. Granted, he always is. His lifelong malaise and existential ennui are integral to his character and formulates the premise upon which the entire show is based. Mob boss seeks psychiatric help to cure his panic attacks. This dour substratum defines The Sopranos, and even though one could certainly argue for it being one of the funniest, most entertaining shows ever made, as we no doubt will at some point, it's the show's penchant for painfully human, enormously powerful drama that continues to mark it out to this day. And the closing scene of this episode epitomizes said quality. When Tony finds out an unstable ex-girlfriend of his has recently committed suicide, he is completely leveled by feelings of guilt and shame. Though not nearly enough that he shies away from pulling off a fraudulent housing scheme scam with a friend who is a corrupt politician. For Tony, his criminal activities allow him temporary distraction from the abyssal blackness that ever encroaches upon his soul in one of the show's prevailing ironies. But in this episode, even in crime, he has nowhere to hide from his own tortured heart. Awash in grief and attempting to quell it with the scam, his friend the politician, whose name is Zelman, derails any hope Tony had for peace. Zelman tells Tony he has started romantically seeing another of Tony's exes, a young Russian woman named Irina. Tony is surprised, but magnanimously grants Zelman his blessing to see her, to Zelman's visceral relief, and they graciously part ways. But we as viewers have been trained for years to be wary of Tony and his frequent emotional vicissitudes. He is perhaps the most frighteningly unpredictable character in fiction. And in one fell swoop of one gorgeous pop song, flaunted perfectly by David Chase, the colossal weight of Tony's heartbroken sociopathy crashes down upon us and Zelman with a raw power as unexpected as it is utterly crushing. The song, Oh Girl, by the Shylights, is a smooth, achingly poignant lamentation for a relationship on the brink, sung and played with such shameless passion that I can imagine even the most abrasive of cynics, like Nick, having a hard time opposing its charms. The song haunts Tony throughout the episode in question, playing multiple times as if to taunt him with the shadows of his loves lost. But it's in the final instance, while he's alone, driving his car at night, when such a harmlessly beautiful pop song plays and somehow sparks a scene, a piece of cinema that truly assaults the viewer with a brute emotional force, unlike anything any lonesome book, song, movie, painting, or sculpture could ever hope to accomplish. The song starts. There's a soulful harmonica. That voice. Oh, girl, I'll be in trouble if you left me now. Tony sings along, and he cries. It's adorable. We remember why we love him, why he fascinates us, why James Gandolfini is so breathtaking when playing him. Tony Soprano is so profoundly human, so enslaved to his expansive emotions, so flawed and multifaceted that he defies the limits of the TV screen and becomes real. He achieves total verisimilitude. It's warm. It's sad. And then he wipes his tears. He chuckles. We guess at himself. The song continues to play. Tony smiles. Tony smiles. And then the smile changes. Ever so slightly. A micro expression. And his eyes, wet with tears and full of bashful scorn, change. And a maleficence grows in them. The smile becomes that of a shark. And his eyes go dead. He turns the steering wheel. The song continues to play. Oh, girl. He pulls into a driveway. He bangs on the front door. Irina answers, confused. Tony barges in. The song continues to play. Zelman is in pajama shorts, ready for bed. His bedroom door opens. He turns towards it. And there stands Tony, a hulking, frowning beast, clad all in black, his massive hands clasping a leather belt with a frightful grip. The song continues to play. Oh, girl. Tony lashes Zelman in front of Irina with a savage, harrowing intensity, stopping finally when his once friend starts to cry in pain and shame. Tony scolds him heartlessly, then turns towards Irina. She has tears in her eyes, but her expression is perplexing, to say the least. A shadow of a smile hangs at the corners of her mouth. Tony looks at her, tenderly touches her face, and then walks away. The credits come up, and the song continues to play. I've attempted to unpack this scene in conversation and within this very essay, but the sheer might of its text and subtext eludes me. What changed in Tony's mind? What made him go to such lengths? What about such a horrendous show of violence did Irina possibly enjoy? What is the scene and song combination saying about love, loss, sex, power, control, dominance, fear, catharsis? I don't fucking know. That's the magic of The Sopranos. It evades easy answers, and that's the magic of cinema. What cinema introduced, though, the pleasurable marriage of sight and sound, this show and David Chase perfected. There are countless scenes akin to this one, rich in theme and oceanic in depth, yet this one lives in my head, rent-free. It is truly devastating. Thanks.
Fuck, man, that was a great essay.
You liked it, yeah?
Mm.
Cool, man, thanks.
So detailed going into that, like unpacking that scene, you know, you feel like you didn't do it.
But I feel like I didn't.
I thought that was a pretty good unpacking. I didn't even like consider those little micro expressions that you spoke of. It kind of just goes over your head, you know? But if you were to study it and look at those specific little moments of change.
I think he was just the master at that, though.
Yeah, like James, it gives you more respect for the actors.
He knew exactly what he was doing. And there's numerous instances of him like singing songs in his car. It's like it's always really kind of funny. You know, he's like a mob boss. He's a big dude. Yeah. He's big, bold and freak. But, you know, he's also really sweet. But, you know, then he's just like the most monstrous monster you could even imagine, you know. Maybe not as much as the Bunyip. Or me with the Nectarine. But like, you know, like James Gandolfini really conveyed all that stuff, and it's the song, that marriage of sight and sound, that song playing, and it's so warm and romantic, but seeing like his expressions in combination with that just change and him looking for some sort of relief through his sociopathy, like, fuck man, it's just a really scary moment, really scary. To the point where like I've shown it to a few people who've watched the show who haven't, and you're always just floored at the end of it. It's like 3 or 4 minutes and just that sequence is just
What fun. Season is that?
So that's season 4, which I'd probably say is like, every season's good, but that's like probably the worst season. Like I feel like it's got the least going on in terms of plot and maybe the most confused in terms of theme. But honestly, I mean, every episode has scenes like that. So you forget.
I've not actually finished yet. Sarah and I got to the final season, but there's fuckloads of episodes in it. And we just got, little burnt out. We were like spamming it and I don't know. It can be a bit miserable. So, you know, you can't be watching something miserable every night.
Oh man, it's definitely, like people forget, it's like it can be very depressing and it's very real. Like very strange things happen, very mysterious things happen, like in life, you know, some things aren't explained. There's a lot of anticlimax, a lot of depression, and it's very, very mature in its dissection of such a theme. But yeah, man, sometimes, you know, you forget it's really funny, but you forget it's fucking devastating as well.
It can be fucking hilarious.
Oh, it's so funny, yeah.
The only other show that I've laughed that hard on recently was Peep Show. We've been talking about that recently. We need to talk about that in a future episode.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about like the POV, you know, where they shoot from, like it's always from their
You get their internal thought. Like how often does that happen in a show where it's good?
Never.
You know, like whenever you get an internal monologue in like a movie, it's like, this is lame. But I think that's the only piece of media that's like pulled it off that I can think of.
It is magic. It's probably my favorite part of that show as well when I think about like the actual the inner monologues. But anyway, that'll be for another
episode. Yeah, let's do that though, definitely, and focus on that aspect of it, because we talk a lot about POV in, you know, written stories, prose.
Yeah, true.
So maybe it would be good to tackle that,
because it is something that does like quite uniquely.
I can't think of anything else.
We tend to try and laser focus on things that I guess particular texts do particularly well, maybe even like uniquely well. Yeah, that's right. You're definitely one of them. Anyway, what a weird episode, dude.
So it was.
Mobsters, fruit, rape beasts.
Australian cryptid.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it is. It's a cryptid.
Well, man, I'm just glad we got to episode 10 before unveiling all this stuff about us. Like, we lured them in, we're like, so we love our moms, and we love our doggies, sort of. And now everyone knows who we really are.
And now this,
yes. Yes.
Have you a quote?
Yes.
Great. But actually, before we get there, as always, if you want to know more about us or the show or support us, go to spinningyardspodcast.com. You'll find our Buy Me a Coffee link there and our links to social media stuff, so like Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, send us money. All right, now for the quote.
So I found a quote online. We usually give a bit of context as for like the writer and who supplied the quote. And I've just read her name. I don't know who she is. I know she's an author. But it's a nice quote. So it's, "Story, as it turns out, was crucial to our evolution. More so than opposable thumbs. Opposable thumbs let us hang on, but story taught us what to hang on to."
What was her name?
Lisa Kron.
Oh, there you go.
I thought it was the bunyip, but it was Lisa Kron.